Celebrating diversity. This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. With former Sunday Times richest journalist Kevin Cahill and me, Tony Gosling. 3 weeks of news to catch up on with Kevin, starting with last night's Ferdinand, that's Prince Ferdinand Sarajevo level provocation, the US and Israeli drone assassination, apparently just the US, although the Iranians are saying the Israelis were behind it too, of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. Along with Putin, the man most responsible for the defeat of ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Now imagine if the chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, who's often seen in Iraq these days, in fact, there just in November actually, what if he'd just been assassinated by the Iranians? How would the Yanks respond to that? Meanwhile, a troop of 12 Israeli trainee students holidaying in Cyprus chanted "The Brit is a whore" at a champagne party back in July when the alleged gang rapist returned to Tel Aviv. And Israel is to be investigated by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, which took place Easter 2 years ago. The ex-Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn does a Snowden, escapes Japan's corrupt courts. What a tale he'll tell in Lebanon. And all faiths riot across India. As President Modi's Israelization law strips Muslims of citizens' rights. And is Greta Thunberg off to New South Wales to sort out the wildfires in Australia? Or, as locals, including volunteer firemen, say, is the real cause of these fires the recent privatisation of the land and water management systems in New South Wales and South Australia, with diverting massive amounts of water to irrigation of new farms that have been created? Also 20 miles away from us here in Kent, the longest general strike in French history has seen petrol stations running dry this week. Not that it's been covered hardly at all here on the news. And that flimsy Trump impeachment. Pelosi and the Democrats appear to be even helping Trump to win a second term because the case doesn't seem to hardly hold water. And Turkey is voting to send troops to Libya to crush the popular resistance there. Another Yemen could be in the making. In Libya, let's hope not. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. This week, Ian Fraser gives us a detailed description of the new Bank of England Governor, Andrew Bailey. And James Garrett, the former head of news at HTV here at Arnos Vale, gives a full interview on whatever happened to investigative journalism. Just a part of an interview which I used a few years ago. This is the full interview. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that right now from dialectradio.co.uk. And before we get into the big news of the day, Kevin, I thought I'd ask you a bit about Andrew Bailey. I mean, we could have talked to the previous guests about this, but this is the guy that's going to be taking over from Mark Carney. Many people say that the Governor of the Bank of England is actually more powerful than the Prime Minister when it comes to making our lives better or making them worse. What's your assessment?
Well, traditionally, it's the Governor who sets the interest rates. Now, interest rates are not that important at the moment. They're very low and they don't have much impact. But Bailey looks like an establishment insider. Carney had some kind of objective viewpoint. He had an alternative viewpoint.
Well, hang on. He was an insider from the Bank of Canada, wasn't he? And
that's
also
right.
From
yeah,
the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, which is even more at the heart of the regulation of the global financial system.
I'm making a distinction between insider in the British system and insider in the international system. Bailey looks as if he'll take his orders from Downing Street.
Well, let's have a listen now to an assessment by Ian Fraser, who's a financial journalist up at the, I think it was the Glasgow Herald he used to write for. I'm not sure if he still does, but he's got his own blog now. And he's also done a book called Shredded, all about Fred the Shred and the RBS crisis in 2008. Ian is really one of the only, I can find, truly independent-minded financial journalists around. And so I spoke to him about Andrew Bailey. There was various scandals that Ian talks about. One is the GRG scandal, the Global Restructuring Group, which is part of Royal Bank of Scotland, where 16,000 businesses were asset stripped and destroyed, as Ian describes it, killed off by the Royal Bank of Scotland, whilst Andrew Bailey was in charge at the Financial Conduct Authority's predecessor. He was in charge of this, and he basically played down all of the criticism of RBS as part of these reports. So basically he's saying, I'm batting for the banksters and against the people who've had their businesses destroyed, the 16,000 businesses destroyed. Also, Ian was critical of something called the Business Support Unit here in Bristol, which is at Castle Park, Lloyds Bank, who was doing something very similar. What they were taking is basically perfectly viable businesses and asset stripping them in order to build up the base of the bank, the financial base of the bank, and destroying viable businesses in the process. So anyway, let's have a little listen now to what Ian Fraser has to say just about this one particular aspect of the new Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey.
It's basically one of these stories where someone emerges as a so-called star manager. And someone like Hargreaves Lansdown, which is, I think, the UK's largest IFA now, basically decides that he is a star, but doesn't bother to properly monitor what he's up to.
This is the Neil Woodford Fund.
Channel as much as they can of their
nearly $2 billion
funds into his
lost,
funds. And you know, don't look under the hood as to what he's actually doing with the money. And in this instance, you know, he made some incredibly poor investment decisions. And he also invested quite heavily in so-called illiquid stocks, which are ones that you can't buy or shares that you cannot buy or sell easily because they're unquoted. Yeah, I think those figures that you mentioned could well be accurate. The investors in this particular fund, the Woodford Equity Income Fund, could lose, I think, around about one third of what they put in. It is currently closed. It was closed in June or suspended, so no one was able to get any money out. From 6th of June, I think it was, 2019, and it's currently being liquidated. So all the holdings are being sold in one way or another in the hope that investors can get as much as they can back. But, I mean, I think in this instance, it does look like Bailey was asleep at the wheel. You know, he should have been doing more. This was one of the most prominent mutual funds in the UK, and, you know, it doesn't look like he or the FCA was doing nearly enough to monitor where Neil Woodford was investing the money. And, you know, there were various red flags that they should have been aware of. For example, Woodford set up his business in 2015, and within 2 months he'd fired his compliance director. Things like that, you know, should have been noticed, I think, by the FCA, and they should have been investigating it. Bailey is very, you know, very much a creature of the existing establishment within finance and within the Bank of England, where he spent most of his career, because he was in the Bank of England. In 95, he was the private secretary of the Bank of England Governor Eddie George during the Barings crisis, for example. You know, so he's essentially a Bank of England lifer, and he's not a particularly creative thinker. He's seen as what's called a safe pair of hands, i.e. don't rock the boat. He's probably very close to the banks, and his time at the FCA, where he has been chief exec for 3 years, suggests that, you know, his priority is not necessarily, you know, the interests of consumers or the interests of small businesses, but it's the interests of of protecting the banking sector. Yeah, there's been a lot of coverage saying, you know, well, hey, what a great appointment. And I, to be honest with you, I don't really fully understand why that has been. It seems like a lot of the financial journalists in the UK, particularly on titles such as the Daily Telegraph and possibly on the FT, they turn a blind eye to a lot of the problems that exist within the financial sector and a lot of the misdemeanors and crimes that happen in the financial sector. And it may be to do with, you know, what I've called access journalism, i.e. they want access to the chief execs of those banks or the boards of those banks, and they don't want to sort of, again, perhaps a bit like Bailey, they don't want to like rock the boat too much. So maybe they just think, you know, Bailey's going to be great and, you know, he'll be a fantastic governor of the Bank of England. I certainly don't share that view.
Okay, so that's Ian Fraser there. I spoke to earlier this week, Kevin. I mean, he's taking a very, very dim view of this guy. He's saying, well, he's a safe pair of hands, basically, for the city. And when it comes to people being defrauded by banks, this guy is going to basically just look the other way.
I think this was what I was trying to say, that he's an establishment insider here. What he'll act to do is protect the establishment. He'll do nothing for ordinary businesses, and he'll take his orders from Downing Street. It looks highly likely. So not very independent.
I mean, to what extent is it Downing Street or the Treasury, Sajid Javid, or the city? Literally, the chief executives, the chairman of the biggest banks in the City of London that call the shots when it comes to what the governor gets up to.
Yeah,
who's pulling his strings more? Is it really Downing Street?
His strings will be pulled by Downing Street. He will not be independent. And the governor of the Bank of England sometimes has to put his foot down. I don't see Bailey doing that. He'll just kowtow and he'll do whatever it is. And I think my hunch when I saw his appointment is that somebody in government thinks there's a big crash coming. And they want a patsy, a fall guy, to make it look good. I think a crash in the currency, if things go wrong, is highly likely.
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Well, on to the international stories, and of course the biggie today is last night's assassination of a senior general in the Iranian army. He's General Qasem Soleimani, and he's the boss of the Iraqi, what are they called, the National Guard. They are effectively
the
Republican Guard. So anyway, what do you make of this, Kevin? What do you know? It's quite significant, isn't it? Really?
I think it is significant. I think it's extremely dangerous.
It's been talked about around the world. It's not just me saying this. As this really is a declaration of war against Iran by the United States.
It's absolutely an act of war. But we shouldn't forget that the chap who was killed was not the nicest of people. He was a nasty baggage who caused a lot of mayhem around the Middle East. He was not what you call a friend of peacemakers. He was a cause of a great deal of mayhem. So, personally, very little sympathy.
But many people in the Middle East, probably the majority of people in the entire planet, would say that the United States has been causing mayhem in the Middle East ever since 2000. And that perhaps, an American general should have been assassinated. Would have been more just.
Well, I mean, the Americans have probably killed far more people than this guy did. But this guy was not a nice guy. But then, that's not saying the Americans are nice guys either. They're rotten, awful.
I mean, there's a basic principle here, and that is that the Iraqis and the Syrians are quite welcome under international law to invite the Iranians in there, invite Soleimani in there if they want to help defend their country, if they think that's a good idea. I mean, for example, Assad invited the Russians in to help defend Syria, and that is okay in international law. What you can't do in international law is just invite yourself in and start killing and bombing, which is what the US has been doing.
Well, the attack on Iraq was illegal. It was a war on a false basis. And the initial destabilization of the Middle East was caused by the United States. Think of the Blair excuse. Saddam Hussein was a nasty baggage. He was. But the mayhem caused by the invasion, when, what, a quarter of a million Iraqis have lost their lives. There's no justification for that. But this assassination is an act of war. And that's how the Iranians will see it. And there will be retaliation, I'm sure. You're talking about the American chief of staff. I think he should stay out of Iraq.
Trump boasts that Soleimani should have been taken out years ago.
Well, he is a protagonist in a number of wars going on in the Middle East. He wasn't a peacemaker, and he wasn't helping to make peace either. But then neither is the United States.
I mean, do you think that there are all sorts of different speculations going on by various experts? One, in the Metro, the headline of the article is "Assassination of Iran General Will Have Consequences Even Bigger Than All-Out War." This is an article by Zoe Druitt. Today, a Middle East expert has warned the killing of Iran's top general is very likely to spark a conflict that could directly impact the US and Europe. General Soleimani, 62, leader of the Quds Force in Iran, was assassinated in an airstrike ordered by President Donald Trump overnight that also killed senior members of the pro-Iran military groups based in Iraq. Senior research fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Dr. Saham Vakil, told Metro that Soleimani's death will have huge consequences and almost certainly lead to loss of life. She said it's very, very likely Iran will respond to the strike with further military action aimed directly at the US. The Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has urged all parties to de-escalate after the airstrike, adding that conflict is in none of our interests.
Yeah. As I said, all that's too late. The assassination has its own meaning. And I think, I mean, you're quoting very credible, engaged commentators. I think the Iranians will strike back, and it'll be something that will be aimed at drawing Israel directly into the conflict.
Well, what Dr. Vakil is saying is Iran has to respond to this attack. Yep. That response is going to be aimed directly at the US. They're no longer going to be dancing around each other. We're bound to see loss of life in Iraq, Iran, and of US personnel. So this does seem to be a sort of turnaround of the so-called Trump policy of pulling out of the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, Trump's policies have been so inconsistent. He's rushed, what, a battalion in to mine the embassy. And then they kill this guy this morning. He'll need more than a battalion to mine the embassy. I suspect he'll need a couple of divisions.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to an Iranian point of view of this, which is was on the BBC World Service earlier today, and that is from Dr. Saeed Mohammed Mirandi at Tehran University, speaking to the BBC's Dan Damon.
He's very popular because he helped defeat ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq. Many believe that if it wasn't for him, in Syria, the capital would have fallen to the extremist forces that were backed by Saudi Arabia, other countries of the region, as well as the United States. And the same is true with Iraq. Iraq was on the verge of collapse. And he went there and personally commanded troops in both countries to prevent the fall of these capitals to these forces. And people in Iran believe that if these two capitals had fallen, we would be fighting ISIS and al-Qaeda and other such groups inside Iran today.
The United States says he also led operations that killed many American soldiers. Do you accept that?
I think it's somewhat ridiculous for the Americans to blame Iran for their illegal occupation of Iraq and to deny the Iraqi people agency. The Americans helped create Saddam Hussein. They created the monster that they later destroyed. They imposed sanctions on Iraq, where roughly a million people were killed. Then they invaded the country illegally and lied about weapons of mass destruction and alleged links to al-Qaeda. They destroyed the country. And then after they helped create the mess in Syria by supporting extremist forces, those forces came into Iraq and the Americans refused to help Iraq when ISIS was advancing on the capital. So the United States is in no position to complain about anything in this part of the world.
Why was Major General Soleimani so vulnerable? We all knew, didn't we, that he was being monitored by the Americans very closely. Why wasn't he protected?
He was on an official visit. He entered the country through the Iraqi airport. There was nothing secret about his visit. And he was met by senior Iraqi military officials who were also murdered by the U.S. Army. The Iranians believe that this is an act of war. And the Iraqis believe that this is an act of war because they also killed a senior Iraqi military hero. And the Americans should not be fooled by the former Saddam Hussein supporters or ISIS supporters or American NGO people who are celebrating in Baghdad. We'll see soon where the public opinion in Iraq stands and how that will impact the U.S. occupation in Iraq.
Donald Trump says he doesn't want war, and he doesn't think Iran wants war because, to quote him, it would be very short. Do you think that's right?
The Americans will not win in any war in this region. Iran is not alone. Iran's allies in Yemen, in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, across the board are on the ascendancy. And Iraqis themselves are outraged by this act of war against Iraqis. The murder of innocent Iraqi soldiers on the front line against ISIS by American troops. Iran is a very powerful country. Iran is not the Iraq of Saddam Hussein. The Americans are in a very vulnerable position, and American allies in the region are very vulnerable. This is not a war that the Americans can win, but the Iranians will definitely respond to the United States, and the Iraqis will definitely respond to the United States. There will be a heavy price to pay.
I think you said on Iranian TV that all Westerners should leave the Middle East. What did you mean?
The situation is very dangerous. Western citizens in the United Arab Emirates and in other countries should leave because the United States has bases in all these countries, in Iraq, and countries like the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, are a part of the U.S. war against the Iranian people.
Yeah, no, I think you're hearing very sane commentary. If you don't want war, you don't do political military assassinations. I think Trump, it's very hard to understand why he let this happen or why he ordered it. Perhaps a desperate Netanyahu.
What about the possibility of some sort of retaliation on U.S. soil? Because this is one of the things the Iranians are constantly complaining about. And like, what the hell are you doing 6,000 miles away from Washington in the Middle East? Go home. And, of course, that's what the American people voted for.
Yeah, I mean, in big power politics, that's a kind of naive approach. One of the issues, and there probably repercussions tonight, is oil. The United States would benefit, I suspect, from a further drop in Iranian oil sales. And if this causes a complete halt, then somebody somewhere is going to make an awful lot of money. But it looks like a silly, stupid act.
I mean, it's a provocation, isn't it? The idea, is to try and get a response, which we haven't really seen so far from Iran today.
I mean, my impression of Trump after 2 years, he quite often doesn't understand consequences.
I mean, I said at the beginning, it's a sort of Sarajevo moment. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand that started the First World War.
Yeah.
In some ways, this guy is a more important figure, General Soleimani, than Franz Ferdinand was.
Yeah, I mean, Franz Ferdinand, when he was first shot, nobody understood why he was important at all. You know, minor royal somewhere on the edge of Europe. And, you know, not many months later, we have World War I underway.
I mean, obviously, this is completely contrary to international law. Is there any international law functioning in the Middle East when the US can just simply assassinate an enemy, so-called enemy army general like this?
Well, no, it's provocation by somebody. But my feeling about Trump and the way he acts and reacts is he didn't think of the consequences.
I mean, surely the Americans are just thinking to themselves, well, we've got all the satellites and the drones. We can do this to them, but they can't do it to us.
I think that one of the problems with urban assassination is it's extremely hard to deal with. I mean, the United Kingdom had what, 30 years of IRA assassinations, I don't think America is secure.
Well, Morandi there, who from Tehran University, you just heard, he's referring to the killing of heroes in the Iranian army in the war against ISIS that were also killed in this attack. So, I mean, this is not going to go down well in Iraq, is it?
No, I mean, Iraq is divided. And it's fairly evenly divided between those who support Iran. And, they're, you know, of course, they'll be up in arms. And the situation in Iraq itself is likely to get worse as well.
Well, there have been protests in Iraq, lots of protests in Iraq. There's the difficult economic conditions there. In a way, this sort of thing makes you wonder, doesn't it, whether maybe this is actually driving the population more into the hands of the Iraqi leadership because they're then now thinking, well, we want the Americans out. In fact, in a way, the Iraqi government are now must be thinking, well, we just want to get the Americans out of this country, but they can't, of course. A bit like Britain, in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, people have forgotten very quickly that the Iraqi government is under threat from its own population. It's been shooting protesters for weeks, and the situation in Iraq is extremely unstable. And this kind of thoughtless assassination, I don't think it's going to help.
Oh, well, let's move on now to talk about the 12 Israeli trainee soldiers who have alleged to have raped a 19-year-old British woman in Cyprus back in July, because this has all come to a head again, as she, who hasn't yet been named, is found guilty in Cyprus of perverting the course of justice. So although her lawyer is saying that she's not guilty and that she still stands by her accusations, apparently in a long police interview when she initially reported this rape, a long police interview took place in which the police persuaded her to drop the charges. And now, then they released these 12 Israelis to go back to Tel Aviv back in July. What do you make of this case? Because it does sound as if a classic rape case, which is not being taken seriously by the authorities. But, I mean, there is also implications here. I'm not sure if you've seen this, Kevin, but that the mayor of Jerusalem is a close friend of one of the parents of one of these Israeli trainee soldiers that's accused of this gang rape.
Yeah, the interview she suffered with the police without a lawyer present. There's huge tourism between Cyprus and Israel, and I can imagine intense political pressure being brought to bear on the Cypriots by the Israelis. And the police interview is highly suspicious. And the fact that she's relatively young and was no lawyer, nobody present for 8 hours, and then she finally withdraws her allegations. It's all highly, highly suspicious.
Well, she's now saying she didn't actually withdraw her allegations. She was forced to do it on some legal technicality. But anyway, this is going to bumble on, this one. It doesn't look like it's going away. Some are saying that this is really an example of the Israeli mafia's influence in the judicial system in Cyprus, and others that actually the Israeli mafia has got a lot of influence in not just in Cyprus, around the world's justice systems.
Years and years ago, I was talking to a Cypriot president, and I said to him, people are very suspicious about your police. They think they're all crooks. And he said, Kevin, they are, but the great thing is, if they're in the police, we know where they are.
Well, that's not really an excuse, is it? And you're not going to get justice from a bunch of people
pressure,
like that.
The pressure the Israelis could bring to bear on Cyprus is substantial.
But what about when the charges against the Israelis were dropped? They flew home to a hero's welcome in Tel Aviv, drinking champagne at Tel Aviv airport and chanting, "The Brit is a whore."
Yeah, it tells you, if you weren't suspicious before, that would make you very suspicious. Well, she hadn't much chance.
How do you think this is going to end in Cyprus? Because how is it going to end in Cyprus? What do you think, where is this one heading? This case, where is it heading?
It'll go into international serious friction, because her lawyers are determined to take it to the European Human Rights Court. She'll probably win in the end, but it'll be grueling.
Also, whilst talking about Israel, the International Criminal Court is going to launch a full investigation into the Israeli state's anti-Semitic, that's my word, war on Palestinian Semites. Because the Palestinians, of course, are Semites. So you could even see this as an anti-Semitism story. Anyway, the International Criminal Court is to launch a full investigation into Israeli war crimes, Palestinians and Israeli human rights groups, hailing the International Criminal Court prosecutor's decision to open an official probe. Chief prosecutor said she will open a full investigation into alleged war crimes in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, an announcement that was welcomed by Palestinians but drew a strong rebuke from Israel. I'm satisfied there's a reasonable basis to proceed with the investigation into the situation in Palestine, Fatou Bensouda said in a statement before Christmas. In brief, I am satisfied that war crimes have been or are being committed in the West Bank, including in East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. The matter of the court's jurisdiction must be settled before the ICC can proceed with the investigation because Israel is not a member of the court.
Well, I'm ex-army, as you know, and one of the things that disturbs me about the situation, particularly in Gaza, is the number of Palestinians who've been shot dead, unarmed Palestinians. And the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, say, oh, the Palestinians are a threat. Well, somebody with a stone is hardly a threat to a soldier with an automatic weapon. And the numbers are very large. I mean, over 150 or 190 Palestinians have been shot dead at the wire. Now, think about when we had a problem with the IRA. Suppose we started shooting protesters at the border. Suppose the British Army had shot dead. I mean, 40 years ago, the British Army shot dead 13 people in Derry and have never recovered from it. Why are the Israeli Defense Forces allowed to kill 100 and however many Palestinians?
Well, look, the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, she says on the 5th of December, the ICC issued a report after 5 years of preliminary investigations and examination of evidence of violent Israeli actions against Palestinians, that there is no substantial reason that an investigation will not serve the interests of justice. So even though the Israelis are not signatory to the ICC, they're going to be pursuing this anyway. And of course, it could mean that specific individuals, because states cannot be prosecuted by the ICC, specific individuals responsible for this in Israel may subsequently find it impossible to fly to many countries that are ICC signatories without being arrested.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of Israeli military figures who could be identified. And it is, I find it astonishing. There is resistance in Israel. I think we kind of forget this when the war of words starts. There is a very substantial part of the Israeli population who object to their Palestinian fellow citizens being murdered by the Israeli army. The human rights groups are fairly strong, but not strong enough, and something like this might persuade the Israeli Defense Forces to stop shooting people.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So, also the ex-Nissan boss, Carlos Ghosn, has done a Snowden, that's what I call it. He's escaping from Japan and what he believes are corrupt courts there, and he's going to be telling his tale in Lebanon, apparently. Now, I must say I have a sneaking admiration for him. Ever since this arrest was first announced, of the Nissan boss, I've been suspicious really about it, because I mean the guy's a very, very top businessman around the world. Is he really some sort of crook, or is it just that his views are not necessarily in line with the political elite, and that he thinks that he's actually in charge of Nissan and he can do what he wants? Well, Nissan is one of those big organizations that whether or not they do a merger with Renault, which I think is what he wanted to do, it should really be up to the business people, not somebody else. But anyway, what do you make of this? It's quite an exciting way to get out of the country, isn't it, in an executive jet?
Years ago, I was an advisor to one of the big big Japanese corporations. And his position in Japan was always anomalous. The Japanese prefer their senior management to be Japanese, preferably samurai. You'd be amazed how many samurai descendants are on the boards of big Japanese.
Sounds to me like you're saying that they're run by secret societies, Kevin.
Well, it is sort of. It's a corporate state, and there's immense emphasis on team playing and playing the game and not doing outrageous things. And he was something of an outsider. But all the stuff looked like corporate politics in Nissan. And a faction in the company wanted rid of him, so they cooked up these charges. And what follows, and Japanese justice is very hard sometimes for us to understand.
It's funny, isn't it? Because financial misconduct is basically what we're being told about what he's being charged with. Although there are quite a few British banksters who've committed enormous amounts of financial misconduct and yet still walk the streets. So we've also, of course, got people like George Bush and Tony Blair, war criminals responsible for the deaths of millions of people that still prance around the streets. So I suppose what I'm saying here is, isn't there some sort of like much bigger problem with justice in the West? The justice system is not actually identifying and finding the rich and powerful guilty. It's being compromised by their wealth and by their power. And we're turning into a nation where at the top level, many of our courts are actually kangaroo courts.
I mean, after the banking crash, the lack of prosecution of anybody. I mean, remember Fred the Shred was never prosecuted. He lost his knighthood, but that was it. And he lost us, one of the biggest banks in the country, and provoked a crisis that threw hundreds of thousands of people on the dole. But Goshen didn't do any of those things. He saved Nissan. And I think...
Yeah, he rescued Nissan from bankruptcy 2 decades ago, around about 2000, and masterminded a successful alliance with Renault. He was arrested in November 2018, shortly after arriving in Japan on his private jet. He faces 4 charges, including hiding income and making payments to dealerships in the Middle East. Well, I mean, surely that is... Isn't that part of the job, to make payments to dealerships? Maybe they were irregular payments to dealerships. I mean, certainly the way that the car industry works, where the, you know, who it is in a particular country that gets to be the main person deciding on who gets distributors for cars, I would imagine that most people from all the big car companies are guilty of doing exactly what he's been accused of here.
In the Middle East, it's extremely difficult to avoid bribing and being bribed. It works both ways. He was reckoned to be one of the cleaner sets of pairs of hands, but I still think it has all the appearance to me of internal politics at Nissan and ultimately a form of xenophobia. They didn't like the stranger being the boss man.
I mean, it's also potentially related to Nissan's other decisions around the world, whether or not to stay here in the UK manufacturing, things like that. It may be that he's just gone against what he's been told to do and become a victim. Anyway, I'm very, very, very interested to hear what he says over the next few weeks in Lebanon to see what reasons he's giving, because he's saying basically he wasn't going to get any kind of fair trial in Japan, which is why he skipped court. And when it comes to the big bad people of the world, Carlos Ghosn doesn't really seem to feature very... I don't think he's going to be going to the International Criminal Court anyway anytime soon.
The other thing, I mean, I think he has a legitimate fear for a fair trial. The conviction rate in Japanese criminal courts is something extraordinary, like 97.5%.
Okay, going from Japan. Japan to India, we've seen President Modi bringing in what's been dubbed the Israelization law, which is stripping Muslims of their citizens' rights. Just Muslims, nobody else. The Buddhists is fine, the Hindus is fine, but Muslims are having all sorts of problems. I mean, basically, this is people who are trying to get naturalization rights in India. They're saying if you're a Muslim, basically, it's going to be almost impossible to get an Indian passport. Now, this is quite obviously discriminating, not because of what someone has done, but because of their faith, Kevin, and which is why it's been compared to the whole situation with Israel and Palestine. What do you make of it? Because the thing is, the people who come out on the streets are not just Muslims by any means. There's people from right across all sections of society in India, including people of no particular faith, are saying that this is just a crazy thing to do. You're stoking up a race war, Modi
is a Hindu nationalist, which he's never bothered to conceal. And he's like all-powerful. I mean, he's like all-powerful people. They never know where to stop. And I suspect we may have a sample of that here very soon, Boris Johnson. But in India, Modi is discovering that there are certain lines you shouldn't cross, lines of fairness. And when a community is functioning reasonably well, which India is, it's sometimes best to leave things alone.
There was an article in the iPaper the other day, which was looking at Islam under attack right across the world, and saying that this is actually just the latest. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, but it's making it very clear that this idea of Hindu nationalism is not going to go down well in India, and it's going to cause a lot of strife. I mean, in another angle on all this, Kevin, sometimes leaders quite like to have strife in their country, don't they? Because they can actually, if people are fighting each other, if there's some kind of big paddywhack going on right across India with people coming out on the streets and screaming and shouting, then maybe they're not thinking that much about the way the country's being run, and that it becomes a distraction from other forms of maybe external threats, like, for example, having disagreements with Pakistan.
Well, no, the biggest problem Modi has is India's GDP. It's been stalled for about 50 years. The top 20% in India are doing fine. The other 80% are living on $1 a day or $2 a day, if they can even get that.
So this could be quite a cynical move, couldn't it? When you've got a lot of poor people who are getting angry, the idea is to try and set them against each other, set the Muslims against others in the country. Interesting. Anyway, is Greta Thunberg off to New South Wales? What do you think?
The little miracle from Sweden. She's had more impact than most people a lot older than her. In fact, the only person who's had more impact is David Attenborough.
And they had a little love-in the other day, didn't they?
Yeah.
But the thing is, the locals over there, I've been looking at some. I mean, I'll put another one. This is another one I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The volunteer firefighters, many of them are saying that actually the problems in there have been caused mainly by the governments of New South Wales and South Australia stopping this process of backburning. This is something that happens in the wintertime, where deliberate fires are set in order to create barriers between big areas of bush. Mm. And the government has stopped people doing that. Another thing the government has done is it's stopped access to the areas, these big national park areas. And they're saying also that arsonists actually thrive when there's nobody around. The arsonists don't take any notice of these prohibitions of anyone going in. Mm. And actually having people travelling backwards and forwards and moving around within these national parks actually helps keep an eye on arsonists, so that if an arson does happen, that it's much easier to find someone who's actually seen a specific vehicle or all that sort of thing, and they can keep track of them because members of the public are much more responsible generally. And the other major thing is the water management. Mm-hmm. Over the last 5, 6, 7 years has been privatised. So you'll find there are whole areas. I mean, I was looking at a video the other day of something called the Darling River, which goes between New South Wales and South Australia, which has completely dried up. This has been diverted for use for irrigation for farms. So whole massive areas that used to be irrigated by this river, and the soil kept damp, Now there's no river. It's all just gone. And so this is what I'm picking up from, not from the BBC or any of the main networks, but really just looking at the locals and what they're saying. Now, they had a big evacuation the other day. The idea apparently is tomorrow is going to be very hot and windy, which will be fanning the flames. And so I think it was on Thursday, the New South Wales government wanted to evacuate a load of people. And they ordered the people to evacuate. The only thing is, the main road, the one road they were being used to evacuate, was closed. So you do wonder what on earth is going on in Australia. It's total chaos in the government, and it wasn't surprising to see ordinary people screaming and shouting at the Prime Minister the other day, Kevin. Anyway, what do you make of this?
The first thing he did with the fires well underway and really big problems, the guy shoots off on holiday. There is this very strange attitude in Australian politics. The chirrupy lad, you know, the hail fellow when met and it's all okay. And actually, it's incredibly irresponsible. And it seems the current government in Australia seems disconnected, doesn't seem to understand the crisis, and certainly doesn't seem to have the brains to figure out where water management might have come into it.
But apparently, I've been reading, I will again put some links up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is the enormous amount of privatisation of this land management and water management. What happens is, as you sell off these things, what happens is big companies move in and they move the water to wherever they want it to grow stuff. There's one, I was watching a YouTube film with this guy saying, well, they've got all these massive almond plantations that have just sprung up, but we can't grow almonds here because we need the water just to keep the normal land irrigated and to keep the rivers flowing. Yep. You're stealing this water, and the government has been complicit. So there's actually an increasing number, it seems, of firefighters over there who are, they feel like they're banging their head against a brick wall because they're working against, a privatised land management system, which is just working for corporations and leaving these vast areas of bush with no water.
Yep.
What about France? Because we haven't heard a lot about the national strikes, which have now apparently the longest in history, just about to become, if not already, certainly for the last 50 years. There are reports of petrol stations running out of fuel now all across France, and we're getting very little coverage of it over here. Biggest general strike for 50 years at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very odd... Do you remember in 1968 when the whole of France was in turmoil and the students were out? This is different. This is much more ordinary people, ordinary workers, you know, people who've been marginalised and lost their jobs and now threatened with losing their pensions. And that's got lots of them on the road.
Well, they're having to take away 2 years of their pension.
Yeah.
So work an extra 2 years and lose 2 years of pension. But the thing is, this is a major plank of the Yellow Vests campaign as well, is on pensions. So they're coming together with civil society, which is the sort of general kind of socialist left-wing people who are seeing the whole mess that's been created by Macron and the neoliberals. So the neoliberals basically are saying, well, the free market should decide everything. Well, of course, the free market means that millions of people end up with nothing. And so that's why they're fighting back. They're not going to have it in France. So do you think that this is the ultimate question, really, is can Macron steal it out and get his way with pensions and people will eventually go back to work?
Well, the strike has shaken him, and he's tried a few little ameliorating gestures, but they haven't worked. And I think there's an acute problem, but it's not. It's happening in France, but it'll happen in lots of other places. If Boris's gamble on Brexit doesn't work, I think we'll have the same thing here when ordinary people start finding they can't get a job, and then finding that the government steals their pension to, you know, make up the cash shortfall.
Well, Well, people can't get a job anyway of the time at decent wages. I mean, we've ended up in this situation now partly because of the mass economic migration where work doesn't pay. So actually, it's not a route out of poverty anymore. So you just end up with more poverty if you get a job.
This is the gig economy, isn't it?
Also, Turkey voting to send troops to Libya to crush the popular resistance over there. Now, this is something we should probably get Joanne Moriarty on. I think there's a couple of people we get on from time to time to talk about Libya, who were the last Americans out of Libya back in 2011, or whatever it was. Another Yemen in the making there? What do you think? If the Turks go in, what will happen?
A lot of bloodshed. One of the things, the Turkish army is one of the toughest in Europe, and a lot of men with guns on both sides, a lot of dead.
So it's been approved anyway today in the yesterday evening, the Turkish MPs have approved a bill to send troops to Libya now from Turkey. Greece, Israel and Cyprus called Turkey's planned Libya deployment dangerous, say Reuters. That's this morning.
Israel calling Turkey dangerous. I think that's somewhat.
And finally, the flimsy Trump impeachment. Do you think they're shooting themselves in the foot, the Democrats?
They need to be very careful. I mean, the odds are stacked against them in the Senate. Each senator has to swear to judge the case by the evidence. So if the Senate lines up with Trump and says he's fine, not guilty, the Senate will be extraordinarily damaged. So it's hard to... I think Trump's base hasn't changed. It's still not...
So this could end up helping Trump, actually.
It's possible.
And that means we'd have Boris over here for the next 5 years, Trump over there. So that's rather nice. If anyone wants a war, now might be a good time to think about it, folks, because you've got the right wing in charge in Britain and America.
Yeah.
I don't want to give people ideas, but it does look as if that's the way it's all being kind of manoeuvred.
Page 245 of running agents in the field. It's all there. And he does very little to conceal the people here who are trying to sabotage the country. He does name them.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So, from World War III to World War II. Well, I thought it would be interesting this evening, Kevin, to just talk a little bit about the potential ability of the Germans to detonate atomic bombs in the Second World War. Obviously, everything was really, really hush-hush at the time. If the Germans were then using that technology and trading with the Allies at the end of the war, they wouldn't be wanting the world to know about that. That would be being kept very secret. I first got interested in this reading a book called Critical Mass by Carter Heydrich, and he talks about enriched uranium that the Germans had being sent in a submarine towards Japan at the end of the war. Once the final deals had been done with the Americans, the two Japanese naval officers who were on board that German submarine apparently were then shot in the head and dumped overboard, and the submarine turned around and went to the United States with that enriched uranium instead for the Manhattan Project. But anyway, how credible is this whole idea?
The first fission event, the first fission explosion was created by Germany in 1938. So if you were a betting person, you'd place your money on the Germans to get there first. They had actually done fission first. And they had people like Heisenberg with Nobel Prizes. And they had the Telemark. Lots of people have seen the film, The Heroes of Telemark. They created a lot of heavy water, which is essential in the process of making a bomb.
Okay, so this is enriching uranium and also using enriched uranium fission to... I mean, the other thing, of course, is that the actual first design for the atom bomb is supposed to have been here at Nuffield University in Birmingham in 1940, Frisch and Piles. One of those, I can't remember which one of the two, was German. The other was Hungarian. So this was a technology which was being developed in that part of the world in the 30s.
I mean, as I say, the Germans got fishing going in 38. The reason that they didn't get any further forward was German science was split into pro-Nazis, anti-Nazis, and lots of the bomb engineers were sent to the Eastern Front and got killed.
There was also, you know, maybe a thinking in the Nazi hierarchy that it was quite nice to use this weapon against the Russians, and the Americans would help them do that at the end of the war. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a quick clip, and I'll put a longer version of it on our podcast at thisweek.org.uk from the author of The Reich of the Black Sun, Joseph Farrell, about the Nazi atom bomb.
In 1943, the Oberkommando der Luftwaffe published a top secret study with a map, and I reproduce this map in Reich of the Black Sun. The map is a map of Lower Manhattan Island in mm-hmm. New York City. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the map, what it shows you is the heat and blast damage radiuses of an atomic bomb airburst at about 1,000 feet of a yield of approximately 15 to 17 kilotons. Okay. So in other words, this is a Luftwaffe study of where to drop the bomb to cause the most damage, you know, over Lower Manhattan. Mm. Wow. It's, you know, it's a creepy map if you look at this thing, especially with the idea that, you know, this is 1943. Why are they...
Oh, that early?
Oh, yes, that early. Why are they making this study?
Yeah.
Well, if they detonated an atomic bomb in October of 1944 on or near the island of Regan, it's because they're getting very, very close. And the final clincher here is in 1992, the American government, the National Archives in this country, declassified a document that's called the Zinsser Affidavit that was given to American interrogators by a captured German pilot by the name of Hans Zinsser, who tells a story that is, when you read it, is chilling, because he tells a story about flying his Heinkel 111 bomber from Mecklenburg, the province of Mecklenburg, up around Hamburg and Bremen and so on.
North Germany.
Mm. Yeah, North Germany. I'm having to say that because most Americans won't know where Mecklenburg is. But yeah. He's flying his Heinkel from Mecklenburg out over the Baltic Sea towards Regan, all right? Mm. And he witnesses a huge explosion, and then he goes on to describe it in detail. Now, listen carefully. He first of all describes what he calls the blast or pressure wave extending out to a radius of about a kilometer, all right? Mm. A little more than a kilometer. Mm. And then he also describes the malfunctioning of his radio and his engines on his aircraft. So in other words, there's electromagnetic pulse. And he also describes what he uses these words very explicitly, a mushroom cloud. Mm. And here's the key point. In the cloud, he describes bright colors burning. So in other words, this is not a conventional mushroom cloud from a conventional explosive. Why? Because you have the continued combustion of the nuclear materials in this cloud. So look what we have. We have a huge blast radius. We have electrical malfunction of the equipment on his airplane. We have the accurate description of a mushroom cloud. And we have a description of the continued combustion of the nuclear material as it ascends in the cloud. And all of this from a pilot giving this affidavit in right after the end of the war, before these details are known publicly and popularly. And he's claiming to have seen this in October of 1944, fully 8 months before the Manhattan Project.
But what does all this add up to? Because most people aren't scientists. So these clues you're giving us.
What they add up to very bluntly is that it appears that the Nazis tested a successful atomic bomb sometime around October of 1944.
But you said it wasn't a regular signature of a regular nuclear bomb.
No, no. All of these things are regular signatures of a nuclear bomb. The point here is that Zinsser is describing things that are not popularly known at that
time. Yeah, that's right. At that point, it wouldn't be.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Huh. So in other words, you know, you add this, I buttress that with testimony of an Italian officer that was sent by Mussolini's government by the name of Luigi Romersa. To the island of Regan. He actually talks about being on the island of Regan, getting in a bunker, having to put on special eyeglasses to view the test and so on and so forth. So, in other words, we have all the details necessary here, plus a considerable degree of corroborative contextual and circumstantial evidence to suggest that they did indeed test an atomic bomb sometime in October of 1944. And of course, you know, this is earth-shaking because this is fully 8 months before we explode our plutonium bomb in New Mexico.
So that's Joseph Farrell there. I'll put a longer version on our podcast at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Lib Dem Bristol Mayor candidate Mary Page, ex-Brexit Party prospective parliamentary candidate for Gloucester, Richard Ford, and also, of course, to former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World, Kevin Cahill. Hopefully Martin Summers will be back next week. We are here at thisweek.org.uk. Do have a relaxing, enjoyable weekend, and don't let the banksters, folks, get you down. And have a happy 2020. God bless.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 8, Labour backbencher Jess Phillips has confirmed her bid to succeed Jeremy Corbyn as leader. The Birmingham MP says there needs to be a different kind of leader. The 38-year-old has warned the party will see more crushing defeats if it does not recognise that politics has fundamentally changed.
I'm standing because I think that we need more honesty in politics, and the Labour Party has got to be honest with itself. It's got to be honest with the country that if we can lose seats like Grimsby, something has to change. More of the same won't cut it.
She's the third Labour MP to enter the race to become leader. Donald Trump has defended the killing of a top Iranian commander, saying he was planning to kill many Americans. Labour wants to know what the UK government knew in advance and how it's going to do now and what it's going to do to keep world peace. French police have shot dead a man in Paris after he went on the rampage with a knife, killing one person and seriously injuring two more. A park has been cordoned off in a suburb 5 miles south of the centre. His junior interior minister, Laurent Nunez.
At this time, I'd like to salute the quick response of Paris police personnel, especially the anti-crime brigade of this area, who intervened very quickly, allowing the assailant to be neutralised immediately, preventing him from pursuing his murderous rampage. This is an extremely courageous act, showing great responsiveness.
Several records for high temperature were broken across the UK in 2019, with the Met Office blaming the climate crisis. It says the last decade was the second hottest in the past 100 years. An employment tribunal has ruled that ethical veganism is a philosophical belief and is therefore protected by law. The landmark judgment relates to the case of a man who claims he was sacked because of his views on animal products. And weirdos and misfits are being invited to apply for jobs in Downing Street. Boris Johnson's controversial adviser Dominic Cummings has advertised several new roles on his blog. That's the latest. I'm Daryl Jackson.